So welcome everyone for our next installment of our JCC Coffee, Cake, and Learning, Purim, Paul Harvey's Rest of the Story. So what we're going to do today is we're going to supply context to the story of Purim. And we are going to see, by the end of the rest of the story, that what happened in Purim did not happen in a vacuum. It was dependent upon issues that had arisen many, many generations prior to the story. So let's look at source one. And this goes back to Jacob, Yaakov. And Jacob went at the behest of his mother, Rebekah, dressed as his brother Esau, and he went with a master stroke of subterfuge to get the blessings from Isaac, who was blind and who Rebekah understood Esau cannot get those blessings. It has to be you, Jacob. He was crying out of pain and anguish because his nature, Jacob's nature, was emet, was truth. This was a contradiction of everything he had lived his life for. And so it was a difficult moment. So when Jacob leaves, a moment later, the door opens and Esau walks in. He wants the blessing. And then, of course, it occurs to him that he's not going to get the blessing because the reveal happens. And Isaac realizes, who are you? Oh, I'm Esau. Then he realized, well, if you're Esau, must be that Jacob came underhandedly and took your blessing. And how did Esau respond? So look at source one. When Esau heard his father's words that not only had his brother Jacob beaten him to the blessings, but Gam Baruch Yiyah, Isaac, who had the power to retroactively curse Jacob for the subterfuge, said he should be blessed. He did not take away the blessing that he had bestowed. He could have cursed him. He did not. So with that, some element of Esau was so hurt and angry, oh, look what he did. He screamed an exceedingly anguished, bitter cry, Adma'od, this bitter cry. Now that bitter cry, just to stop for 1 second, mid-source, that bitter cry was not that Esau really wanted the blessing. I'll explain. You see, the blessing meant that you had to be a religious Jew. You had to go to synagogue and daven 3 times a day and only eat kosher and all that stuff. That wasn't really what Esau wanted. And in fact, the rabbis say that later on, had he actually received the blessing, he would have paid Jacob for the rights to, dear Jacob, my goody two-shoes brother, you're the guy. I want to go out and rape and pillage the world, make tons of money. I'm not interested in being a Shomer Shabbat observant Jew. It's just not for me. However, losing it to his brother, that psychologically impacted him. But more than that, there was a small part of his neshama, of Esau's soul, that was holy, that was good, and that was desirous, perhaps, of this spiritual Judaism that would be lost to him forever now. Now, you can say as a side point, the blessing really was Jacob's. Remember? He sold the rights to the blessing all those years ago for the red beans, for that cholent. Conveniently, Esau forgets that there was a real transaction that took place when they were 15 years old on the day of Abraham's funeral, the famous, you know, give me that red stuff because I'm too tired, I'm going to die, I don't want Judaism. Conveniently, though, all these years later, Esau forgets that the transaction had happened. And in fact, Jacob deserved the blessing because that blessing went hand in hand with the rights of the firstborn, which were now Jacob's. Okay, be that as it may, there was an element of Esau that felt that loss, that anguish. What could have been? I could have been a contender, but I lost it. And therefore, he cried. So that was that a real cry? Absolutely. Was it a cry of mara, of bitterness, of loss? Yes. That had to be addressed in the world. That had to have consequences for Jacob, who caused his brother, through his actions, to emit this cry. So we know there's something called mida keneged mida, measure for measure, that how a person behaves, both good and bad, will be reciprocally brought back on a person. So look at the next little part of section one, source one. Mordechai knew what was happening, that the edict of Haman went out to exterminate the Jewish people. And Mordechai tore his clothes, a sign of mourning, and cried, oh my gosh, exactly the same words, an exceedingly anguished and bitter cry. So the rabbis can connect the dots here. They say, why was Mordechai, this great holy rabbi, why was he subject to this horror of Haman, great-grandson of Esau, right, their connection? So Mordechai, great-grandson of Jacob, was subject to the predations, perhaps, of Haman to the point where he cried over it because Esau had cried. So in other words, whatever went out into the world, the cry of Esau could not remain just unaddressed. God addressed it. Okay, so you see this generational connection there, right? So you have Esau lamenting the loss of what could have been the Judaism, even though he didn't really want it, but a part of him felt the loss. He cried. His great-grandson, Haman, makes Mordechai, Jacob's great-grandson, cry. So you see this generational loop that is closed in source one. So file that away just as a proof of this generational connection between Esau, Jacob, and the story of Purim. Now it's going to get even more mind-bending. You ready? Hold on. I hope you're seat-belted in. Source two. Timnah was a mistress to Eliphaz, the son of Esau. So before we talk about Timnah, let's talk about Esau, shall we? So Esau, he's a bad guy. The rabbis actually say, Halacha hi biyadua she'Esav son es Yaakov. It is an absolute established fact that there is hatred, enmity between Esau and the Jews, Jacob and his children. And it doesn't have to be based on anything real. It just is. Esav sone et Yaakov. Esav always has this hatred in his heart for Jacob. Okay. Now, but Haman, Amalek, who are the family of Haman, they don't just have hatred in their heart. It's one thing to have animus, but to act upon the animus, but even more, to act upon the animus to the point where even if you, Haman, have to die, you're happy as long as Jacob dies. That's a level of malignancy and toxicity that is not just Esau. It's not found in Esau. So just for a moment, speak genetically. In other words, Esau has the hatred. So it's the source of Haman's anger and resentment for Mordechai and the Jews. Yeah? But alone, in a vacuum, it's not sufficient to supply the psychological damaged Haman who's willing to mortgage the bank and his own life if it means he can kill the Jews. Where did that come from? It came from this lady in source 2, Timnah. You ready? So who is Timnah? She's a concubine. And she's mentioned in the Bible, in the Torah, very briefly. They said there's a man named Lotan, who is a descendant from Esau's family, and he had a sister named Timnah. And the rabbis say, well, why is that even consequential? What do we care about this guy Lotan, who's like a prince, and his sister was Timnah? Who cares? Rabbi said, no. This is consequential. Why? Because if Lotan is a prince, what does that make Timnah? She's a princess. She's royalty. And what happened to her? So look at what happened to her. She, the Talmud tells us, this is from Sanhedrin, she, Timnah, wanted to join the Jewish people. She wanted to become part of the Jewish people. Now remember, the Jewish people at the time were Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, right? There weren't the tribes, there weren't the 12 tribes, there wasn't a nation. It was just limited in scope to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and their family. Okay. So she was desperate, Timnah was, to be a part of this very famous Choshev, important family. So she approached Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and she wanted to marry into the family. She was a beautiful princess. She says, hey, I want part of Judaism. But there must have been something off about Timnah. Oh, yeah. There was something really off. And then when Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and Sarah, I'm assuming Sarah and Rebecca were the ones who met this young, beautiful lady, and they felt, you know, how women have this chush. They have an ability, you know, beyond men. Sorry, guys. But women have an ability to see things that are not even there and to feel them as a reality. And so there must have been something about Timnah that was dark and off-putting. So even though she was seemingly desirous to marry into the family of the Jewish people, they kind of said, sweetheart, I'm sorry, but this is not for you. So she was disappointed and hurt. And she went home and she took out her genealogy chart. I'm just making this up. And she looked at the genealogy chart and says, well, at the top of the genealogy, there's Abraham married to Sarah, right? And then Abraham and Sarah, they have Isaac. We're not talking about the Ishmael character because that wasn't from Sarah. So you have Abraham and Isaac, and then you have, Abraham and Sarah, and then you have Isaac, yeah? Okay, Isaac marries Rebecca, but they have twins. So if I can't get in, Timna thought, to the Jacob side of the genetic line, but Esau has the same genetics as his brother Jacob, yeah? In other words, Esau's mom is Rebecca. His dad is Isaac. His Zadie and Bubby, his grandparents, are also Abraham and Sarah. So if they won't have me, Timna said, I have a plan B. I'll try to get in and marry in to the Esau side of the family, yeah? So she approaches Esau's son, his firstborn son, Eliphaz. Eliphaz was the one who infamously robbed Jacob on his way to get married, and poor Jacob had to work all those years for Rachel and Leah. You know the rest of the story, but that's not for now. So what happens? Even Eliphaz she's a beautiful woman, and she's coming and offering herself. She says, look, I want to get married. What say you, Eliphaz? So she's beautiful. She's a princess. Eliphaz already has a wife or two. You know, back then it was like Utah, right? It was okay. So Eliphaz is looking at Timna and he says, you know, you are beautiful, you're great, but Dayenu, you know, I have enough wives. It's enough. I got a headache already from the wives. I don't need another wife. Thank you very much. You're beautiful. I wish I'd met earlier, right? Okay. Timna says, okay, fine. Let's not be husband and wife. How about I'll be a prostitute, like a concubine? Are you okay with that? So he's a guy, right? So Eliphaz is looking. She's a beautiful woman. He says, yeah, you know what? A pelegish, a concubine, you know, I can handle that. There's no, like, marital vows and rights and stuff. I don't have to worry about inheritance necessarily. Yeah, sure. I could always have an extra girlfriend. Just don't mention it to my wives. Okay, so they hook up, and she's the pelegish. Now think about this. She, Timna, was so hellbent on being part of the Jewish experience that she, as a princess, is willing to demean herself essentially as a lady of the evening, as a concubine. And it's demented and dark. And you should not be surprised when the source goes on to say, listen to what she says out loud. I would rather be a maid. We're using a very calm word, because the word is pelegish. It doesn't mean a maid. It means a concubine. I would rather be a concubine among this nation of the Jewish people than a princess among any other. She's warped. What came of Timna? Timna was a mistress to Eliphaz, the son of Esau. And she bore him Amalek. Wonderful. Bravo. Thank you, Timna, for that. Beautiful. So here you have Esau's enmity. Esau hates Jacob. And then you combine his son Eliphaz's inherited anti-Jewish thing, but it wasn't extreme. But then it becomes extreme because Timna throws her genetics into the mix. Together, the toxicity of Timna, her insanity, her drive, at any cost, I must be a part of the Jewish people, even if it means demeaning my royal status, right? I'll become like Prince Andrew. I'm sorry. Sorry, I couldn't resist. I couldn't resist. I'm sorry. Come on, that was good, right? I was just reading that poor Charles the King is like beside himself. How to get this guy? He's destroying the monarchy of England, right? So she's destroying her own. That was too easy. I'm sorry. Just don't send this to Andrew, okay? And I want to insult the poor guys. He's already down on his luck. I don't want to shtuch him anymore, okay? All right. So Timna takes her royalty, throws it away, becomes a concubine, and in her mindset, she creates a Amalek. And think about a Amalek for a moment. They are unique. They had absolutely no bone to pick with the Jews. We had nothing on a Amalek. They're just this crazy situation that Timna maybe felt pushed away from Abraham and Isaac, but she still managed to get into the family, maybe not in an ideal world, but she made it in. And all of a sudden, the Jewish people are leaving Egypt. We're at the zenith of our powers. We are on the way to Mount Sinai. And we don't have any territorial grievance with Amalek. Amalek were like a little Bedouin family. We were never given the land of Amalek as an inheritance. They had no bone to pick with the Jews. And yet, what did they do? Look at source 3. This is the biblical account of God in Deuteronomy of why Amalek is nefarious. And now we know where Amalek got this nefarious mindset from, this lady Timnah and the Esav elements of her husband Eliphaz. You shall remember, God tells us, what Amalek did to you on the way when you went out of Egypt, how he, Amalek, happened upon you on the way and cut off all the stragglers at your rear when you were faint and weary, and he, Amalek, did not fear God. Therefore, it will be when the Lord your God grants you respite from all your enemies around you in the land of Israel, which the Lord your God gives to you as an inheritance to possess, that you, the Jewish people, shall obliterate the remembrance of Amalek. From beneath the heavens you shall not forget. This is such a significant moment that these three verses are read on the Shabbat right before Purim. It's called Shabbat Zachor, the Sabbath of Remembrance. And by hearing these three verses read out loud, we actually perform a biblical commandment, one of the 613. Wow. Because Amalek is the anti-God, anti-Jewish force in our world. Very powerful force. So again, where did Amalek get this nefarious, potent, toxic mindset that they at all costs will kill the Jews? It all came now. You know a little bit of the rest of the story from this insane person named Timnah, this demented woman who made herself a prostitute rather than a princess. So now we're going to jump forward. But before we jump forward, in the biblical real-time account in Exodus of that attack that we just spoke about in source 3, God tells us something very interesting. He says, you know, you Jewish people, you're going to have to make war, and I will make war against Amalek. But he says, midor dor, from generation to generation. You know what that means? It's a very profound but very sad and very tragic reality. You can't kill Amalek in any given generation. So the Amalek that appeared in Rephidim, when we were journeying to Mount Sinai, that Amalek that Joshua led the army out to fight, and Moses and Aaron and Hur are praying, and God wins, we win the day, right? But that was part of Amalek. Later on, a man named King Saul, the first king of the Jewish people, he is given a dictate to fight Amalek. King David fights Amalek. Mordechai and Esther fight Amalek, Haman. We had a very unsuccessful 20th century Haman named Adolf Schicklgruber Hitler, Yimach Shemo, may his name be eradicated, who was Amalek. And I really believe that on October 7th, there was another part of Amalek that reared its head against the Jews. So in every generation, we have to deal with the Amalek that will be in our generation, that is unique to us. So in other words, again, we're not going to go into the hows and the whys, but it's a reality that God lays out for us. So what I'd like to do now is discuss what happened with King Saul, because it is so profound in terms of its impact on the story that I think you'll really get something from this. So there was a TV show about King David, and they had this guy, King Agag. He's a very big guy. Who was he? He was the Amalek king in the time of King Saul. So who was King Saul? King Saul was chosen as the first king of the Jewish people. And he wasn't meant to rule as the only king, because he comes from the tribe of Benjamin. And as you know, the tribe of Judah were given the rights to the monarchy. That was David and his family. But before David became king, Saul was the first king of the Jewish people. He was anointed by the great prophet Shmuel HaNavi, Samuel the Navi, Samuel the prophet, who loved Saul. And when we meet Saul originally, he was this incredible shining light. He was a man who, when they were trying to introduce him on the stage, I love this moment, Samuel uses the God-induced Urim V'Tumim, these little stones that would light up and show the answers from God. And he's on stage. He's about to introduce all of the Jewish people to their anointed king, that he's already been anointed secretly, but now he's going to publicly give Saul over to the people. And Saul apparently was like a magnificent specimen. He was tall. He was handsome. He was humble. How humble was he? So it's actually humorous, but Samuel is announcing, now your new king, Shaul ben Kish. And they're looking around on the dais. There's no king. So Samuel's probably like, you know, puts the mic up like this and turns off the mic. Hey, where's the king? We don't know. They start looking around for the king, right? Normally, as you know, politicians are, they may be great people, but humble they're generally not. Because think about it, to be a politician, you are essentially saying, well, elect me because I'm worthy, you'll vote for me. So there's an element of hubris and self-awareness there that makes a person a politician. By definition, no matter, again, that's not a slight against a politician. It's just reality. Whereas Saul was chosen by God against his will. He didn't want it. So you know where they ended up finding him? He's hiding up in the baggage cart. In like, away. And they find him. He's like hiding out. And they say, no, Saul, you have to be introduced to the people. All right, fine. And they bring him on stage. So it is so tragic then that poor Shaul, Saul, loses everything. He didn't even want it in the first place, and yet it's foisted upon him. So it's a very tragic story that has a crazy, sad ending where he is ignobly killed, he and his son Jonathan, by the Philistines on a battlefield. And it's horrific. It's a horrible story. And he loses his kingdom over what happens in Source 4. He loses everything, his life and his kingdom. Okay? What happened? Saul was told by God through Samuel the prophet, you must do what Moses did, make war against Amalek, wipe them all out. And it's a very tough one. Men, women, children, possessions, all. Many rabbis who are not necessarily orthodox or beyond have had issues like morality of how do you kill children? It's a tough one, right? It's a really tough one. Now, the obvious answer is that if you don't, the child's going to wake up one day and they're going to be 20 years old and they're going to come after you. I understand that. So there was a book by Stephen King called The Dead Zone. Anyone ever heard of it? They made a TV show and a movie with Christopher Walken. Famous. If you don't know it, I'll just tell you why I'm citing this story. So in this story, this young man, Johnny, has the power to see the future, that he didn't want it again. And he meets this politician. He shakes his hand by mistake. And he sees this vision that this guy is going to bring nuclear Armageddon to the world. So he knows this guy's going to do it. It's going to be reality. But right now, he's a local politician running for office. So he goes to his doctor, played by Herbert Lom. He was the Pink Panther Inspector Clouseau's boss. He's a famous actor, okay, character actor, Herbert Lom. He plays a Jewish doctor that Johnny has. And he says to the doctor, he says, you're a Jew. He says, yes. He says, if you could go back in a time machine to like Austria in the late 19th century, and you could meet a little Adolf Hitler, what would you do? So the doctor's thinking, it's an incredible question. Like, you know, you're in the DeLorean of Michael J. Fox going backwards. Would you do something? It's a young Hitler. He's not yet Hitler. What would you do? So the doctor has had a profound answer. He said, I have dedicated my entire life to saving and preserving human life and the sanctity of human life. He said, without reservation, I would kill the SOB. That's what he said. So it's a tough one, yeah? But to kill Hitler before he, right? I mean, it's really tough. This is part of the equation here. So Saul is told, kill everything. And he, by the way, he does. Except the king, Agag, is given a reprieve. Now, Saul probably has his chokmah here, his wisdom. Why would you give the king of all the Amalekites a temporary reprieve? Maybe he felt he could embarrass him and shame him, bring him up for justice, whatever that meant. So look at Source 4. Saul seized Agag, the king of Amalek, alive. And then he also completely destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. So apparently Saul didn't have a problem killing men, women, and children. But the king he didn't kill, and the sheeple on all the possessions. He allowed his own people to take possession of the animals with the pretense that they were going to sacrifice them. But the people wanted the money, although they were told, no booty. You can't keep the loot. It's not yours. Amalek stuff has to be wiped up. They didn't. So when he comes to him, Saul said, I did the word of the Lord. Yay. And he like salutes, says, I did everything you asked. And he hears like the ma. So Saul is told by Samuel, almost like as a joke, he says, meh. Like, what is the bleeding of the sheep that I hear? Where do those sheep come from? Yeah, you did everything God said, really? And Agag is alive and well? What's going on? And then, of course, at that point, Saul understands the enormity of his avera, of his sin. And he starts to beg forgiveness. Poor Samuel is thunderstruck. Look what God says in line 2 of source 4. God says, Nicham, I regret that I have made Saul king, for he has turned his back from following me, and he has not fulfilled my words. And it distressed Samuel, and he cried out to the Lord all night. Poor Samuel's broken. And Samuel said the next day, bring Agag, the king of Amalek, near to me. And Agag went to him delicately. And Agag said to Samuel, right before he's about to be executed, surely the bitterness of death has turned. Remember the word bitterness was the cry? It's sort of like that same word mara, like maror that we eat, the bitter herbs that we eat on Passover. Okay, so Amalek, the king says, you can kill me, but it's not really going to help you anymore. I'm sorry, Samuel. The bitterness of death is gone. I'll explain in a minute what happened. And Samuel said, as your sword bereaved women, so will your mother be bereaved among women. And Samuel hewed Agag in pieces before the Lord in Gilgal. So Samuel kills him. He executes him on the spot. Samuel, who never lifted a finger in war or battle, he understands the word of God means Agag dies. It's a problem. Unbeknownst to Samuel and any other human being, but not unknown to God, the line of Agag continues. Why? Because his wife came to him while he was in confinement in prison, and they had an affair, and his wife became pregnant with a child, and that child would eventually become Haman. Wow. How do we know this? Because when we first meet Haman in the book of Esther, it's like a description that makes no sense. They say, Haman ben Hammedata. So far, so good. Haman, the son of Hammedata. Okay. Ha-Agagi, the Agagite. The what? What is an Agagite? You're looking at your book of Esther like, what does that even mean? Oh, the book of Esther is making this connection to right here, right this moment. That no, he only exists because as Agag's great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandson, he lives. He's here to destroy you. Incredible, right? An incredible moment that connects the generations. But what does this mean to us? So look at source 5, and it's incredible. This is one of the most mind-bending Talmuds you'll ever hear. Let me just set the stage. You ready? So Jacob is constantly dealing with his big brother Esau. They have a meeting, a faithful meeting in Genesis. They go their own way. Esau goes back to his possessions in Har Seir, and Jacob goes on with his family. The story of Joseph and all that stuff happens after. But according to the rabbis, Jacob continuously sends gifts to big brother Esau. He gives him 550 animals, like real stock portfolio, literal, right? As a gift just to butter him up in the moment of his meeting. And then subsequent to the meeting, he's always sending him bribes. You know why? Because Jacob is desperate to keep Esau at a distance from his children. And he wants to keep him fat and happy. And if Esau has lots of money, if he's got lots of cryptocurrency, he's a happy guy. He's got gold and silver and money. He's a happy guy. And when Esau's a happy guy, guess who he doesn't fret over? His brother Jacob and what the Jews are doing. He's happy. Yeah? Okay. What happens, though, when Esau or his children are unhappy? Then they all of a sudden look around and they lament, just like Esau lamented with that bitter cry. Well, why are the Jews the chosen people? That could have been me. I mean, my grandfather Esau made a bad choice. Yeah, but that could have been me. I could have been the chosen people, whatever that means. Yeah. Okay. So Jacob knew this. And he actually saw somehow that there was an element of Esau that was so dangerous to his children that he prayed to God please stop this element from ever manifesting itself. This is going to bend your mind. The Talmud is redacted in the year 500. Look at source 5. Direct quote from the Talmud. Said Jacob to the Holy One, Ribono Sha'olam, Master of the Universe, do not allow Esau his heart's desire. Do not remove his bit that's controlling his violence. This prayer, the Talmud says, refers to Germania, which is Germany, of Edom. Edom is the nation of Esau. For if they were to be let loose, they would destroy the world. Now, this is beyond belief. This is like the most prescient, mind-bending little Talmudic thing you're ever going to hear. Now, how do I unpackage it for you? In the year 500, there's no Germany the way there is today. It's the aftermath of the fall of the Roman Empire. Yeah. So the Romans are Edom. They're descended from Mr. Esau. They're part of his family. Okay. But there were Germanic tribes in Europe. So if you look historically, from the year 500 all the way up to the modern Germany, there were Germanic people. So he, Jacob, according to the Talmud, already has some inkling that in the future there could be something, an Amalek dormant gene that would manifest itself through Germany and present a clear danger to the Jewish people and to the world. Amazing, because if you, imagine, if you're learning this Talmudic piece any time before like 1925 maybe, when Mein Kampf or whatever is written, maybe you have an inkling that something is not holy over in Germany. Okay, World War I wasn't great, right? But it wasn't the Nazis. It was a war. It was a crazy war. Archduke Ferdinand, that makes a lot of sense to me, by the way. I've never understood the whole dynamics of the politics of World War I. Okay, but World War I was not, it wasn't on a Nazi Reich. That happened later. It's all embedded here. So none of this would have made sense to you learning Talmud until like the 1930s. Can you imagine how shocking it would have been in the 1930s and 40s? You're learning the yeshiva in Lithuania or whatever, and you're learning this and you realize, I can imagine people fainting. Like just they would have been discombobulated when they read this and said, oh my gosh, this is prescient. This is like the reality that our world is in. Now, there's something unique about Amalek, and there's something horrifically unique about the Germans. You see, Jacob had a plan. Remember what his plan was? I alluded to this. Bribe Esau. Keep him fat and happy. And that worked, as long as you're Esau. But if I throw Timnah into the toxic mix with Esau, it changes the dynamic, yeah? You can't bribe Amalek. And I'm going to show you this historically. One of the greatest tragedies of World War II, of the Holocaust, was what happened to the Hungarian Jewish community. Because you see, Jews in Europe did not necessarily perceive who Hitler and the Germans really were. They had dealt with really bad people over the generations. As my wife always likes to say, if there was never a Hitler and the Nazis, Yimach Shemam, the worst person in history to go against the Jews was Khamenei. And if you learn about the Ukrainian man, this insane man, Khmelnytsky, and what he did to the Jewish people, because we were part of the Polish Empire, they still have like streets and places in the Ukraine, in Kiev and that, like immortalizing this horrific Nazi-style guy, Khmelnytsky. So I don't have to tell you, between the pogroms and the blood libels, there's so many, they're not even historically like memorable, because they just all conflate into one. But there were so many horrible things over the years, but the Jews always were able somehow to survive. It cost us, but we lived another day. How did we do it? We were like Jacob. We used to bribe the authorities. There's famous stories. I won't go into ad nauseum giving you, citing, you know, stories, but I'm sure you've heard about how, like, during the Tsar, you know, very often the Jewish community would raise money and they would pay off the local officials to kind of look the other way so that this Jewish yeshiva student wouldn't have to be conscripted into the Tsar's army, or, you know, they would use money to sort of bribe officials, and it always worked. And per capita, I believe, the Hungarian Jewish community had more money than anybody. And they always felt they could just use their money and influence, and they could grease enough people in the political system, and they would survive. You can't grease the palms of Amalek. They don't take bribes. And horrifically, the Hungarian community were not sent to the gas chambers until, I believe, 43, 44. Very late in the Holocaust. They could have been saved. Many of them could have been saved, especially with their money. They probably could have gotten out, but they didn't. They believed erroneously that they're dealing with the same old hatred of the past. How do I know that Amalek can't be brought? Because it's in the book of Esther. Look at source number 6. Haman goes to King Ahasuerus, the king, in chapter 3, verse 9. And he says to the king, there is a nation who are separate and they are indistinct, but they're not together. We don't have to fear them anymore. He doesn't mention the word Jews. So he says, Your Royal Highness, sell them to me as slaves, and then I can, you know, I can do away with them. He doesn't say it out loud, because, you know, King Ahasuerus doesn't want his name sullied that he allowed genocide against the Jews. So it's like a wink-wink conversation between Haman and King Ahasuerus. So look what Haman offers the king. If the King Ahasuerus is willing, sign a decree to destroy them. He doesn't mention Jews. I put it in parentheses. And I, Haman, will personally hand over 10,000 talents of silver to the royal treasury. So not only can you not bribe Haman, Amalek, Hitler with money, they will willingly give up their own money to you to kill the Jews. It's incredible. Now, Haman didn't end up having to pay the king. Right? The king said, look, you know what, Haman? Here's my ring. Send out the letter in my name. Do your worst. Keep your, by the way, 10,000 talents of silver is a couple hundred million dollars by today. So we're talking a lot of money, okay? Big bribe. And so in other words, Haman is willing, for the honor of killing the Jews, to pay you to kill the Jews. You can't, in other words, if you try to go to him and say, Haman, hey, you know, can you imagine the AIPAC lobby were working really hard in Shushan after the edict went out. They tried to get access to King Ahasuerus, you know, they tried to bribe. There was no way to bribe. The only person who could save the day was Esther. There was no one else, right? So it was so this is such a powerful idea that Jacob understood all those generations ago that when you're dealing with the normal Esau and his normal children, you can negotiate with them. You can keep them happy with giving them a little money here and there and keeping them distant from the Jews. But when it comes to this nation, Amalek, they are unique. They cannot be bribed. They're not rational human beings that can be dealt with in a rational way. It's impossible. All right. Are you ready now for source 7? So Mordechai and Esther have this incredible conversation through messages because they can't be seen together. Haman has put guards everywhere, TSA agents at all checkpoints in the capital, because he knows that once the edict, the letter goes out, that in 11 months from now, the Jews will be genocided, real genocide, men, women, children, the whole thing. He knows the Jews are not going to take this lying down. We're going to try to go to Ahasuerus, the king, and get him to change his mind, to help, yeah? So he's suspicious of the Jews. Who is number one on the hit list? Mordechai. He hates Mordechai on a very personal level. It's personal animus he has against Mordechai the rabbi. So if Mordechai is seen around the capital, especially in the company of Esther, the game's up. He'll know that Esther's somehow not a neutral subject, but she's on the side of the Jews, and he'll probably have her executed. So they can't be seen together. So they use messengers, right? There's FedEx guys going back and forth between Mordechai and Esther. And so Mordechai says, you know, you need to go to the king and help. And Esther replies, look, I wish I could, but the moment is not correct. The king is crazy. He's locked himself at Haman's behest into an inner chamber. He only holds court there. And there is a rule that Haman helped initiate. Anyone who goes in, anyone, even me, the queen, the rule is if you don't have an official summons, a hasmana, from the king to come, and you barge in without an invitation, off with the head. And they don't delineate between me, the princess, the queen, and anyone else. So I'm risking my life. I can't go. It's not an opportune time. Let's wait. So Mordechai responds to her. Look what he says in source number 7. For if you, Esther, remain silent at this time, relief and rescue will arise for the Jews from elsewhere. Meaning the Jews will be saved, but it won't be through you, Esther. Okay. And then look what he adds. You, Esther, and your father's household will perish. And who knows whether it was just for such a time as this that you attained the royal position as queen. So Mordecai says something very profound. He's saying, look, Esther, it's looking pretty good, 95%, that God ordained that you should be selected by this maniacal King Ahasuerus to be his new queen, and that you're able to withhold your identity until this moment in time. It's been years now that Ahasuerus has been trying to elicit from you your genetics, and you've held it back. So it's looking pretty good that you're who you are in your unique position, because you and only you can effect salvation for the Jews. I can't guarantee it because I'm not God, but from a human perspective, it's looking pretty good. Yeah? Okay. But I understand that you're reluctant to go. So don't go. Don't go. Just stay away. Well, what will be the result? The Jews will win. We'll get saved from somewhere else. I don't know exactly how. Maybe a King Cyrus type guy will come from outside of the kingdom and make a war against Ahasuerus and Haman, and he'll kill everybody. And the edict against the Jews will be forgotten, but it will be a generic salvation. There'll be no Book of Esther. There'll be no Holiday of Purim. There'll be no Habentaschen. Ooh, okay? So all these horrible things, nothing will happen, okay? But he adds a caveat. Did you catch the caveat? Not only will you lose out on the moment, your father's household. Well, what could that mean? You know that Esther is a direct descendant of King Saul. Great, 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 great granddaughter of poor King Saul. King Saul is now dead in heaven. But poor King Saul is powerless to undo the one crime that he committed against the Jews. He allows King Agag to impregnate his wife, unbeknownst to the world, and Haman is a product of the crime against God that Saul allowed. Saul's dead now, but his soul is waiting for you, Esther. You're the only person who can redeem your great-grandfather's crime. He's waiting in heaven. And if you don't go, Saul's done. You, uniquely, Esther, are in a position. Your father is waiting for you to go to save his life, his soul in heaven. Wow. And Esther goes, and Saul is redeemed. So again, it's just incredible, the generations that connect Jacob and Esau. And then you have the connection of Haman as a result of King Agag and Saul, but then ultimately you have this redemption. So when it says for the Jewish people, there was light and redemption and joy, it wasn't just for the Jewish people here now in the city of Shushan. It was for what happened before. So my takeaway for you is it's a profound idea. Our actions do not only impact the here and now, but we are progeny of our parents and grandparents and great-grandparents. And it's going back a long way, Abraham and Sarah, that far. Every action and inaction impacts the souls of our ancestors. And it could be any little moment. There might be something that was unachievable by one of your grandparents or great-grandparents. But it could be achieved by you in this world. And so my hope and my prayer is that everything we do should be an aliyah, an elevation, and a gift to our own parents in the same way that Esther gifted Saul ultimate salvation. This Purim, may we gift our own parents and grandparents that same salvation. Thank you.